This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fan hounds.
It's a weekly podcast and you better listen. Keep your ears in mint condition. Ooh, Hot Travel Fanboys.
You got a 33-1/3 chance of winning.
Hot Travel Fanboys. 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 Hot Travel Fanboys.
Hot Travel Fanboys.
Hot Travel Fanboys. Hot Travel Fanboys.
Lord have mercy, the hard traffic fanboys are back again.
Yes! 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 Yes!
Welcome!
Yes!
Ladies and gentlemen, to the L-shaped studio in Ho Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Celebrate good times, come on!
My giggling companion there is Nick Duke.
Nah.
He is very happy today.
Nah. Hey. Goodbye.
And I am Greg Phillips, and we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And that sound you hear is not Nick Duke snorting cocaine. That is Nick Duke sniffing. And why is he sniffing? Because he's on a hell of a roll right now, folks. 2017 is ending on a high note for the Dukester. And we'll be getting into some of the reasons behind that a little bit later on. We are presenting to you here in this lovely month of December a special all reading and watching and the rundown edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. It's no secret that this is a pretty busy month for everybody. A lot of us have tight work schedules and then vacation schedules planned out. So we've got a podcast that we've recorded in advance that we're going to bring to you this month. We've got another one we're going to record, and then this week we're just going straight for our weekly segments to go through some news and notes around the comic book world. And before that, we're going to hit you with reading and watching.
Reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What have you been reading and watching? Tell us.
And before we get right into that, Nick, why don't you tell people at home, how's your week and how's your month been so far?
Oh, it's been fair, decent, not too shabby. Yeah. Quite frankly, I'd suggest that some of the writers and showrunners over on a little program called The Walking Dead have a hell of a mind for this business, quite frankly.
Will they be getting fruit baskets from the Duke Depot for Christmas?
They just might. No, they'll be getting, I'll be sending them all copies of DJ Eclipse's brand new album now that he has time to focus on his future endeavors. Woo!
You have any, well, we'll get into that and maybe a little bit of the Chandler Riggs dad of it all at a little bit later on in the show. And, you know, things are just going your way this month, Nick, and This really, this last little stretch of time here has been great for you. You know, you're on a roll. Your predictions are going solid. Your things that you've been wanting to see have been being realized on the screen, whether it be on television and movies or even in the world of football, where I would remind you that the Auburn Tigers are not the SEC champions.
But the Georgia Bulldogs are, so there you are.
And, you know, things are going well for you, sir. And I figure what better time to start off with, or what better person to start with this week than you, because I know you've got reading. I do not. I don't have any reading, actually.
I didn't read anything.
Wow. Yes, good. I've been reading a little bit of this Jason Aaron and John Cassidy Star Wars for our upcoming Longbook Hunters episode.
Oh, you have started it already. Good job.
Well, I started today and realized that the first issue is 48 pages or something like that.
Yeah, it was a big book. I think they charged like a $5.99 cover price for that first issue.
So I'm into it, but it may take me a little bit longer than I was anticipating. But we're going to record that as soon as I finish reading that book, hopefully over the weekend, if I am not comatose or dead by then.
Well, the good news is there's no football to interfere this weekend for me on either day, so we can do that at any point. True. But let's not bore the audience with our staff meetings.
Go Trojans on Saturday at noon against the North Texas Mean Green.
The Mean Green
on ESPN.
Quite frankly.
In any event, neither one of us has reading, so let's get right into watching.
Yes, let's. Let's.
We talked about you know, there's only one place to start this week, let's be honest. I am going to warn everyone right now. There will be spoilers starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Particularly, there will be spoilers as it relates to AMC's The Walking Dead. Now, if you choose to continue this podcast, you do so at your own risk if you have not watched this episode of AMC's The Walking Dead. You can skip ahead to later in the show if you'd like. There's no telling how long this rant will last, but...
No rants. No rants today, my friend. It's all positive feelings and celebration.
What I will say is there are certain truisms as it relates to my cohort and friend, Nick Duke. He enjoys the Georgia Bulldogs. He enjoys the Atlanta Falcons. He enjoys alcohol. And he absolutely despises Carl Grimes. Whether it be in the comic books, but particularly as it relates to the television series, AMC's The Walking Dead. Nick Duke has gone on historic Emmy-nominated rants on our show about the continued frustrating existence of Carl Grimes and his frustrations with the actor who portrays Carl Grimes, one Chandler Riggs, he of the ever-increasing hair and the ever-present eye patch. Now, the progression of Nick's hatred has been a straight line up since this first season, but it's been a gradual upward diagonal line. You're doing a line graph of this, and it's reached a crescendo long ago. But I believe that Nick had lost hope, had given up hope that his dreams could one day come true. And then came Sunday night and the mid-season finale of The Walking Dead, which was structured in a way that would indicate that Carl Grimes would probably be the character that would be killed in the episode. However, was also positioned in a way near the end to make it look as if they were going to swerve us and make Michonne be the character that would actually get whacked at the end of the episode. But instead, after all of this rigmarole and this intense battle with the saviors as Negan destroys the town of Alexandria, it seems like everything is well. And then Rick and the survivors from Alexandria, they go into a tunnel in the sewers below, and they're meeting up, and everyone is somber. And Rick gets to the end of the tunnel to find a very pale Carl, who is sitting there, and he lifts up his shirt to reveal a Walker bite. Now, as we know from the show, a Walker bite usually means certain death. But sometimes, if the bite is on the leg or the arm, there may be some saving the character. Carl's bite is right on the torso, so there's really nothing they can do to save poor Carl. And as soon as the scene happened, I heard a noise off in the distance. I cupped my hand to my ear, and I said, "What sound doth emanate from yonder?" I walked out onto the porch, the balcony of my second floor apartment here, in beautiful, luxurious, in beautiful, luxurious Dothan, Alabama. And I leaned over the guardrail ever so slightly, and I heard the noise again. And there, all the way from Fort Mitchell, Alabama, and the Duke household, I could hear coupled with uproarious laughter. And I knew that joy was taking over the Duke household. So I think what everyone's been waiting for, Nick, what everyone who listens to our show has been wanting to hear, give us your reaction. Talk us through the events of Sunday night and give us your reaction at the time. And now that you've had several days to reflect on it, what does this moment mean to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that was absolutely amazing in every freaking way. The little sumbitch is finally gone. He's finally gone, Greg. All these years of just doing the opposite of whatever other wiser people tell him to do has finally caught up to him. And I was worried after the episode, I was worried that they were just going to inexplicably cut a chunk out of his torso and save his little ass. Because as we know, being shot multiple times at point-blank range can't kill this kid. Being held captive by Negan can't kill this kid. Nothing kills this fucking kid. He is the John Cena action figure to my car tire, is what he is. He has escaped certain doom so many times that I was only halfway convinced, and it wasn't until showrunner Scott Gimple confirmed on Talking Dead that this bite is going to play out exactly as other bites on the show have played out. And so, when the mid-season premiere comes, as I told you on the phone, I think it's going to be a time for me to turn the lights down a little bit, put some candles on, maybe put on a little Barry Manilow in the background, and just watch the show and spend some good quality time with me. Get to know myself, quite frankly. I can't wait to watch this kid sweat and suffer for an entire episode. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be one of the best episodes in the history of The Walking Dead. I am going to enjoy it in a perverse fashion.
Get a little hand moisturizer, perhaps, going.
Well,
just to stay fresh for the episode.
That's right. Quite frankly, that's not for me to say. But no, going back to before the episode, you and I had talked just before it started airing, and you got my hopes up about Carl being the one. I had not even considered the possibility, and then you mentioned it. And so I sat down to watch the episode, and as you said, from the moment the episode starts, it's kind of structured in a way that makes you think, okay, Carl's in trouble here. Either he's in trouble or Rick's in trouble here. And that's the other thing. That's the true saving grace of all of this, is not just that Carl is gone, but Greg, I had become increasingly convinced that at some point they were actually going to do the Rick kill off and make Carl the de facto lead character of the show, which is something that would be a Seinfeld gif worthy moment for me, where I would probably just cease watching at that point because I would have no interest in watching a Carl led Walking Dead. But so anyway, the episode starts and you have that whole thing going on, and like you said, throughout the episode you keep thinking, man, they are really teasing this Carl death here. And they started teasing it. They were teasing it to such a degree, Greg, that it made me feel certain that there had to be some sort of swerve coming. And then, like you said, near the end of the episode, they kind of swap point of view characters and make it Michonne getting into Alexandria. I became very concerned for her. And then, and I got to be honest, most of the episode I thought was just kind of okay. I thought there were some really good moments, but I wouldn't call it out as a standout episode of The Walking Dead. until the last 30 seconds. Because then they went and did something like that and totally redeemed
themselves. I thought it was a good episode overall. You know, there were interesting things that happened. I think it didn't need to be 90 minutes. I think we can agree on that. There wasn't enough going on to fill 90 minutes, really. But there were some cool scenes. I thought Maggie was a badass in the episode.
Oh, Maggie was awesome. The only way Maggie could have been any better was if she had turned the gun on Jesus.
Yes.
Now that Carl is finally gone, I got to find a new one.
I think it's going to be him.
I think it's going to be Gabriel. I think Gabriel is still right there. But I think Jesus and Gabriel, Jesus and the priest, those are the two that I'm most wanting to get rid of.
The two people with biblical names.
Yes.
He's insufferable, but Maggie was so badass. The other thing that she could have done, I really want that long-haired savior to die, but I think he might be being saved for Morgan, maybe.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot going on there at the Hilltop. So honestly, at this point, I know Alexandria just got destroyed, but I'm more intrigued by what's going on at the Hilltop than I am any of the other locations like Alexandria and Kingdom.
Although Ezekiel was great, too.
Ezekiel was great. Jerry was, I mean, it sucked to see Jerry in such a dire set of circumstances.
Now, wouldn't that have been just the ultimate in the agony and the ecstasy for you, Nick?
Nope.
If I would have given it.
I would have taken that sacrifice. Jerry would have had to have been the one that died on the cross for Carl's sins, Greg, and I would have had to accept that.
So you get all that stuff going on. There's a very dangerous moment with Jerry. That one thing that we do have to address, though, that I think both of us had some issues with is the off-screen escape of the Saviors from their unescapable predicament.
There is a vague reference made to music being used to lead them away, but you know, we saw the speaker truck that the Saviors had destroyed. We saw, you know, Eugene blow lose the boombox parts that he had on that model on that remote controlled airplane. We saw a lot of different mechanisms for them to get out already destroyed, and it seemed like they just wanted to gloss over the finer points of how the Saviors escaped. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but it could be one of those things that, in true Walking Dead fashion, they're gonna reveal in a non-linear fashion.
Right. I have a feeling that that's coming, and it wouldn't. Given the way that Walking Dead premieres suck usually, especially mid-season premieres, it wouldn't stun me if when they come back from the mid-season premiere, it doesn't entirely focus on the Savior's escape and showing how that happened, which I think would be kind of lame, but that's in keeping with Walking Dead premieres.
Extend the Carl of it all for another episode.
The Carl of it all, yes. Make you wait to have to open your masturbatorium to the world. But I did have a little bit of an issue with that. But I thought that Ezekiel was great, Maggie was great, all that stuff was interesting. Negan was at his charismatic best.
Yes.
As he was tearing apart Alexandria. He had a very good scene with him and Carl where they had a kind of a heart to heart, or what seemed to be a heart to heart. And then Rick and Negan had a throwdown in Rick's own kitchen of his house in Alexandria, and he has Lucille in his hands with a chance to bash Negan's brains in, and doesn't, and gets kicked in the balls for it. So good stuff all around. The one thing that I will say that did bother me a lot in this episode, and overall I really liked it, but they have got to end their obsession with the slow motion close-up montage of people's faces.
Right.
What is the deal with that this season, Nick?
I have no idea. It is their attempt at being artistic, I think, and it often falls flat, especially when they do it multiple times in the episode, as they did here to open and close the episode. But, you know, I can't complain too much, Greg. Beggars can't be choosers, and this beggar
absolutely.
Was finally...
And it was a good episode, and it was one that gave us a lot of... some people have been complaining that the season has moved too slowly. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I can see some of the complaint. In this case, they actually had a lot of forward momentum on the plot. Things moved forward, even while moving backwards in some respects with regards to, you know, Negan back on a reign of terror. So overall, good stuff. But the real thing here is Chandler Riggs leaving the show, which apparently... his father went on a Facebook rant about how he was pissed at Scott Gimple for he lied to his son and told him he'd be on the show for 3 years.
He lied to his son, huh?
Yeah, which I don't know that I've ever seen an actor, or certainly an actor's family member, complain about being written off of a show for story purposes.
Yeah, screw him. I don't give a shit. Complain all you want to. Take your son and his no acting ability having ass, take him on to Auburn University. They deserve him.
Well, he's going off to L.A. to do some some new movies.
Go make some shitty mixtapes, DJ Eclipse. Get the fuck out of here.
He's going to go to L.A. and he's going to film movies about Vipers.
Good for him. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back. No more, no more, no more.
Here's the real question. Do you think he gets a haircut now?
Don't give a shit, because I won't have to watch him anymore.
What you're saying is your give-a-shit's flooded.
My give-a-damn is busted, as the
That's
old
right.
country song
yep.
used to say.
Yep. My give-a-damn's busted. Yep. So, with that being said, any final words you want to offer to Carl or to the audience about Carl?
Carl can fuck himself in the afterlife, and I hope that the season ends with Negan taking a giant dump on his grave.
There you have it. Strong words from a strong man, Captain Insano. Well, let's move on to our DCCW shows from last week. When last we talked to you, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Nick, we had reviewed the crossover episode.
Yes. So now all that's left is the mid-season finales.
The mid-season finales. And we kicked off last week with a bang, in my opinion, with this mid-season finale of Supergirl. And it saw us picking up the threads that were dropped right before the crossover episode with the return of Mon-El and his girlfriend, Imora. Is that her name?
Imra.
I think. And their references to the future of the Legion of Superheroes, who are actually named in the episode as the Legion of Superheroes. So that's a big moment. But then the primary focus of the episode is Kara as she continues to struggle with the fact that Mon-El is married to another woman. And that this woman seems to be perfect. She's, very beautiful. She's smart. She is very kind. She's even looks up to Kara. And Kara is still struggling with the inherent unfairness of the fact that Mon-El and Imra are happy and she's not. And we also get to see the continuing saga of Rain as Samantha, who has been a great addition to the show with she and her daughter Ruby. She's finding herself blacking out and losing chunks of time as she's turning into Rain and beginning a reign of terror of sorts as she's killing criminals and thugs throughout the national city region. And so this is where it all comes to a head, and we finally get a confrontation between Rain and Supergirl. And it leads to, number one, a horrifically bad costume on the part of Rain. but number two, I'm going to go ahead and say it, the best live-action version that we've gotten of the Superman Doomsday fight, even though it's Supergirl and Rain. Much better than the fight in Batman vs. Superman, much better than when they did it on Smallville. It was awesome. It was right off the comic book page, the way they destroyed the city, the way the beat down, the way the bruises were even showing up on Kara reminded me of the way that Dan Jurgens drew the bruises on Superman in the Death of Superman comics. I thought it was an awesome fight scene. Really, really good use of CGI on the episode. I thought Kara's progression throughout the episode was really good and adds depth to her character. I pretty much liked this whole episode, man. I thought it was awesome. I think it was, if not the best episode of the season so far, right up there among the top two or three best episodes so far this season. And they did a great job of investing me in the Rain character, especially that ending where you're not, she whips around and you're not sure if she's Samantha or if she's Rain when Ruby walks up to her. It's really, really well done. Big fan of that. And I have to say, as much as I dislike the James Olsen character, I actually don't have any issues really with James and Lena. I don't love it, but I don't really have any issues with it.
No, here's the issue, Greg. Here's a character that's really interesting in Lena. We like her. We can't really get a good read on her. We want to know what her deal is and where she's going. We're intrigued by her. We seem to generally like her and her dynamic with Kara. Here's James Olsen, who's uninteresting in every conceivable way, and we don't care about. And we already know his dynamic with Kara is overly boring. Why do we want to attach the dead weight of James Olsen to the neck of Lena Luthor?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you bring up a great point, and I agree with you. James Olsen is uninteresting, and I was still holding out hope that perhaps in her depression of losing Mon-El, that perhaps Kara would have to fall into the arms of one of her best friends. But nonetheless, I thought this was a great episode, man. I really liked this. The fight was great. The stakes felt real. The level of menace of Rain to me is far beyond most of the villains they've had on Supergirl, on any of the seasons. Even though it's another Kryptonian villain, to me she feels like more of a threat than the previous Kryptonian villains have felt. Maybe at least since season one finale. Mm-hmm. So, big fan of this one.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. You know, I'm still a little iffy on the whole Rain personality swapping angle with Samantha, but once they actually got to her, you know, being in the costume and displaying her powers and the fight scene and everything was great. So can't really complain too much. Like you said, the Kara and Mon-El stuff was very good. Getting to see more of Carl Lumbee as Martian Manhunter's dad was good. So yeah, just all around a really good episode and one of the better mid-season finales.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Carl Lumbee there, because I really enjoyed the return to the brown water gag. That was very, very effective, I thought. And he's just very charming as Jean's dad. So big fan of that. Fan of the entire supporting cast, really, on that show for the most part, other than James. And we'll have to see where they go from here, but I'm sufficiently intrigued to see where all this stuff goes. And we've talked before, Nick. We don't know a damn thing about the Legion of Superheroes.
Not a thing.
Not a thing. So it's very much going to be an introduction of sorts. I mean, I encountered them on Smallville, I think, but I don't remember much about them from there. So this will very much be an introductory type situation for me. I mean, I know the bare bones basics, but they've really got a lot of cash to play with, at least in my mind, for people that like me that and like you that maybe grew up in a time where the Legion wasn't exactly an A-list brand, so to speak.
Right. Has the Legion ever been an A-list brand?
I feel like back in the 80s, maybe, but I don't know. Back in the 70s and 80s, I feel like the Legion was a very popular subset. Maybe kind of like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a Marvel equivalent. Maybe somewhere on that level of like the Galactic stuff for Marvel in the 70s and 80s. You know, gotcha. I don't know, but maybe that's giving them too much credit. I don't know, but I know there's a lot of fans, and we know a lot of fans. Todd and Kelly are huge fans of the Legion, so happy for them, no doubt. Now, Tuesday brought us the mid-season finale of The Flash, which has had a mostly good season to this point. Maybe not great, but a good season to this point that have been having some great episodes lately. And this kind of introduces a very new twist to the Thinker storyline as Clifford DeVoe managed. Well, we'll get to that in a second, but the villain of the week, so to speak, in this one is the return of Amunet. And she, played by Katie Sackhoff, I believe, comes back looking for Caitlin's help to save a metahuman that she wants to basically turn out for another person, basically. So, it's a pretty straightforward episode. Caitlin wants to prove that she's just as valuable as Killer Frost is. Meanwhile, Barry is getting ready for a showdown with DeVoe, and we find out early on that DeVoe wants Barry for something that he's going to be doing that night. And DeVoe ends up capturing Barry and locking him in this weird prison thing. And we think that that's the goal, is to keep him in this prison thing and experiment on him in some way. It's clear that DeVoe wants to jettison his body for another, based on the dialogue that they're having. Well, as it turns out, Amunet gets defeated. They rescue Caitlin, although inexplicably, they let Amunet go instead of incapacitating her in any way or capturing her in any way. They just rescue Caitlin, knock down Amunet, and then leave. So I thought that was weird. And then at the end of the episode, it turns out that this guy that they helped Caitlin save, well, what a twist! Spoiler alert. Because there's a huge twist at the end where it turns out that DeVoe has switched bodies with this guy. And, oh, by the way, paying off of a really good throwback from the very first scene of the show where they're looking through wedding gifts, turns out he frames Barry for his own murder, the murder of the original DeVoe body. And looks like Barry's going to prison as we end the mid-season. As we begin the mid-season break. So, a lot going on here. I thought all of the stuff with DeVoe was awesome.
Yep.
I thought all of the stuff with Amunet was not awesome.
Yeah.
So
it was all right, I guess.
It was pretty... Overall, I came away from this episode going, it was all right.
And I enjoyed...
It was fair.
I enjoyed all the DeVoe stuff to such a degree that it kind of helped make up for all the Amunet stuff. Like, I walked out of it not really remembering the Amunet stuff and just focusing on how great the DeVoe stuff was.
Right.
Although I was a little disappointed to see that actor who's been playing DeVoe go by the wayside. I hope they find a way to bring him back in some fashion as the season goes forward, because I think his portrayal has been very creepy and one of the better villain portrayals they've had on the show in a while.
He's been awesome, and I'm the same way. I'm very bummed about that. I'm also a little confused because... Well, two aspects of this. Well, number one, why would DeVoe not have just wanted to go into Barry's body?
I think the gimmick was they had to find a metahuman who had the ability to accept others' thoughts the way this Brainstorm character did. And so he had to have a specific power set in order to make sure that the transfer would work.
Right. Well, that brings me to question number two. Why did they capture Barry?
To make sure he didn't save... Amunet and put an end to the entire thing before it got started.
Gotcha. Well, that makes sense, I suppose. I was just not a huge fan of this one. But that being said, I'm very invested in DeVoe, and I thought all the DeVoe stuff was great. His wife continues to be good as well as an actress and a character, even if she's devious. And I'm curious to see where they go from here, as I was with Supergirl, to see where it all goes, so that the forward momentum of the plot is interesting, even if that particular episode I wasn't very high on. But let's move on to Legends of Tomorrow. And what I thought was another tremendous episode that can best be summed up by the words, Bebo hungry. I thought this one was awesome. I don't even know... I honestly don't know what to say about it. They go back to the early 90s, which is a great time set anyway, and we find young Martin Stein, and then he gets transplanted back to the days of the Vikings, landing in the New World back in, 1000-something. And that's also an interesting time period. So right off the bat, you're dealing with an interesting time frame. You're dealing with interesting characters. The guy playing young Stein did a really good job. And again, it's an episode that is so freaking funny, and then out of left field will just hit you with an emotional punch with the Jackson-Stein relationship that you're not expecting. This was another example of what to me has been a stellar season of Legends of Tomorrow. I don't think they could have ended on a much higher note. I was in I was in tears laughing at a couple points, and then the emotional gut punch of a character that I think has really stepped up this year, and the actor playing him is Jax, because I never knew that he had this level of emotional depth in him, and he's really done a great job this year, even though it looks like he may be departing the show for a little while. And then the great twist at the end with Constantine being on the ship. I mean, there was a lot to love here.
Yeah, there was a lot of good things going on. The Bebo gag was funny, where a child's doll from the 90s is transported back in time and becomes the god of the Vikings and causes all kinds of funny repercussions throughout time. That was good. Even the burgeoning romance between Sarah and the bitchy Time Bureau lady didn't bother me as much as I expected it to.
Right.
Yeah, just all around pretty good episode. Can't
and how great was Malcolm Merlyn with the Thor wig?
You mean Damian Dark?
Damian Dark with the Thor wig as Odin. Yes,
that was pretty good. And then also the dynamic between Earth X Leonard Snart and Leo Snart and R. McRory was very good as well. I enjoyed that.
Totally, absolutely, big supporter of Legends of Tomorrow. And then that brings us to Thursday and Arrow, which has the kind of, oh gosh, now I'm trying to remember what happened. I watched it first. Refresh me, Nick. What was the plot of this one?
Well, you had Oliver and Felicity celebrating their...
Their
marriage.
Celebrating their wedding. Yeah.
Yes. With a party with friends and whatnot. You get lots of good callbacks during that scene, whether it was Lance and Felicity's mom getting a scene together, mm-hmm. or...
By the way, let me see if I'm doing this right, Nick. Mama Smoke Hashimashi. She ages well, my friend.
You threw me off. Or Thea and Wild Dog having a dance while Thea recounts her failed romantic past, including the really lame DJ character from season 2. That was or season 3, maybe. Yeah. I can't remember which one.
Yeah,
that was good as well. So yeah, just a lot of good little callbacks in that scene, and then it goes in straight into the reveal that a member of the team has turned informant on Team Arrow and has agreed to testify against Oliver. So you have that, and then all along, all the meanwhile, you have Caden James putting into action his latest plot, which, as it turns out at the end of the episode, was just a means of attempting to tear Team Arrow apart further or fragment the team further, which succeeds because...
Which works, yeah.
By the end of the episode, Team Arrow is no more, at least from an expanded point of view. You have John and Oliver and Felicity, and the characters of Dinah, Renee, and Curtis have all decided to take their leave. And don't let the door hit them in the ass on the way out.
Thank you. I was hoping you were going to say that, Nick, because I was about to say, let me put out my potentially controversial hot take. Good riddance.
Now, that being said, I wish there was a way to keep Dinah on board, but if finally we can get rid of Wild Dog, I will swallow that sacrifice.
And here's the thing. I put this on Facebook, Nick, and I'm putting it out there for the world. You all know, everybody out there listening that's listened to our air reviews knows, Wild Dog has really grown on me this season. They've done so much to, in my opinion, rehabilitate his character since about midway through last season and make me care about him and make me invest in him, even find him funny. I think he's been much better comedy relief than Curtis has, at least in the last season, like half a season or so. But in this one episode, they undid it all.
Right, because not only does he turn informant on Team Arrow, he then gets indignant whenever Oliver won't trust him complicitly after he has turned informant on Team Arrow. Like,
and don't even get me started on Curtis the bitch, Holt, who's like, oh God, I didn't like the way it made me feel that you spied on me. What do you do to all of these criminal people?
And what did you want him to do? Confront? I mean, like, Oliver raised a solid point. How do you know they're going to tell the truth? They pretty much took the only action they could have taken. Now, that being said, I would be highly surprised if the team isn't back together soon.
Oh, they're going to. It's pretty evident from watching the preview of the second half of the season, the team's going to have to come back together in order to take down this alliance.
Yes, because...
The alliance to end Hulkamania.
Yes, the reveal at the end of the episode is that the vigilante character, Caden James, the Black Siren, Ricardo Diaz, and some other guy are all working together to take down Team Arrow. Who was the other guy? Did you recognize
the him? Other? They've been showing the other guy since the beginning of the season, and I have no idea who he is.
Oh, and Anatoly, that's the big one, really.
Anatoly was the big one, and that was the one that was the big shock moment to me because I was like, not Anatoly, come on. You know, I love me some Anatoly, Nick.
I know you do.
Anatoly is one of my favorite recurring characters on Arrow, and now it turns out he's a baddie,
yeah,
as my good friend Matt Eagleson would say.
They're really going to have to do a good job of explaining why not only Anatoly, but also the vigilante character will be willing to work with criminals that are, you know, stating their goal of destroying the city. That doesn't make much sense to me from either perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting to see they're going to have to do a Walking Dead-like episode where they retroactively explain how that team came together.
Yeah,
and show it. Because Anatoly clearly has been pushed to a point now where he feels like he feels like he has some unpaid debt of revenge against Oliver that he needs to take out. And or either it's just a means to an end to secure his foothold in Star City. The rest of them is pretty more straightforward, I think. But yeah, it was a very shocking reveal when I saw Anatoly walk out there. But I thought that was shocking. The reveal of the mole was genuinely shocking to me because that's the one character. I mean, I knew it wouldn't be Curtis, but I didn't think it would be Wild Dog either. I thought it would either be Dinah or it would be a character. My fear was that it was going to be Diggle.
Yes, mine as well.
Yeah, and I would not have liked that at all, honestly. But then to reveal, or that it would be nobody, and that it would be just a false planet story, possibly even Roy coming back. But I did not see the Wild Dog reveal coming. And then once it did, I said, "Get his ass out of there." And when Dinah and Curtis defended him, get their asses out of there too. You know,
yep.
I like Dinah fine, but shit, you know. We've had vigilantes on the show that weren't on Team Arrow, and honestly, as much as I Arrow's my favorite of the shows anyway.
Right.
But I don't think every character team of six people or seven people.
I agree. Like,
I kind of miss when it was just Oliver and Diggle and Felicity doing their thing, and you know, I'm gonna enjoy watching Oliver on his own for a little while.
Nobody is mentioning this sixth character. Who is this guy? I looked at like four different articles. Greg, and they all mention Ricardo Diaz, the Vigilante, Anatoly, Black Siren, and Caden James, and yet there's another guy just standing there. Who the hell is this guy?
Nobody knows. They've never named him. He's there all the time, and they never name him.
Is he just Caden James' right-hand man or something?
I guess he is. You know, maybe he's the bird or the trog to his bane.
Maybe he is. But no, in any event, one thing that I wish would happen. So let's see, you got the Vigilante, you got Anatoly, you got Black Siren, you got Caden James, and you got Richard Dragon, and you got this other guy. That's six.
Mm-hmm.
So I would rather them have original Team Arrow, Thea, Roy Harper, and
yep.
I guess you have to have Dinah for the Vigilante take on this new threat rather than bringing Curtis and Renee back.
Yes, in some ways it makes more sense that way because everybody would have... Everybody would kind of have a potential pair off there, you know. You could pair off Dinah with Vigilante. You could pair off Felicity with Caden James, kind of mind to mind, mano a mano. Diggle with Richard Dragon. Oliver, you could go with Anatoly, of course. And then you can assign Roy, the anonymous guy.
Yep.
And Thea, whoever the other one is.
Also, official prediction, Black Siren is turning babyface by the end of the season.
Yes, absolutely.
Either turning babyface or dying. One of those.
Yes. Or maybe both.
Maybe both, yeah.
And I will say, that was another thing that I actually surprisingly enjoyed because of the stellar acting of Lance, Quentin Lance.
Yes.
He was great in that episode, and so I really liked the scene where he talked Laurel down. And that was good. What I didn't enjoy was Laurel fighting, which she just stands on a show where everybody has such awesome fight scenes. It just stands out every time she throws a punch. But nevertheless, good episode, I thought. Not great, but good.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
All right, time to rank them. Rank them.
Oh, this is tough.
You go first.
Yeah, you go first. I gotta think about it.
Oh, hell on earth. Okay, I'll go ahead and go. At number one to four or number...
It doesn't matter, so however you want to do it.
At number one, I've got Supergirl, followed by Legends, followed by Arrow, and then followed by The Flash.
God, I'm going to go So hard. Let's go Legends. Let's go. Oh, let's go. Legends and then Flash and then Supergirl and then Arrow. And that's hard, but I liked them all this week. All of them.
Yes. The margin for me at the top between Legends and Supergirl was razor thin. Because I had Legends at the top and then I finally flip flopped. But it's very, very close.
Yeah, honestly, all of them were pretty close to me because, like, objectively, Supergirl is probably the best, but I don't care about those characters as much as I do the other characters.
Right.
And so it just kind of all evened out for me. And I loved all the DeVoe stuff on Flash to a degree that carried that one. So, yeah, really tough. One of the toughest weeks to rank them for me.
Well, with that being said, how about we move on, Nick, to another weekly recurring segment?
Or how about we take a break since that's all we're doing this week?
Oh, that's a good point. Let's take a break and let's hear from some of our sponsors. And then when you hear our zero non-existent sponsors, let's hear from some of our other podcasts here at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, and NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when shopping online and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We've been celebrating.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you listened very intently to all the great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation, Place to Be Nation Pop, such as our friends over at Sellers Point, over at Geek and Sassy, over at Conversation Comics, and of course, Sunday Groove, a.k.a.
Easy Like David Sunday.
That's right. And in addition to those great podcasts with our good friends there, you can also listen to the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast
in all Place to Be Nation. As you're currently doing. And we're going to get right into it now, folks.
What other, other podcasts can they listen to, Greg?
Well, God. Well, there's always Go Home in a Box.
Uh-huh.
There's the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, of course, Imaginary Stories Podcast.
Three stars.
Well, what we've got for the people this week, Nick, are some strong style stories from the world of comics, and those are as follows. Because we have our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics, our weekly look at that which we call
Welcome to the
And Nick, I don't exaggerate when I say we've got a veritable heaven.
A veritable heaven.
Of comic book news and notes. And let's start with the biggest of all comic book news and notes. And it's a follow-up to a story that I feel like we've been talking about for a month now. And that is the recurring story of Disney's efforts to buy the film and television properties and other things of 20th Century Fox.
Mm-hmm.
The latest in this, according to CNBC, is that a deal for 20th Century Fox to sell the bulk of its media assets to Disney could be reached as early as tomorrow. As we record this, Thursday, December 14th, which will probably be a few days before you guys hear this. Now, Comcast has publicly backed out of the acquisition talks, so a Fox-Disney deal could reportedly be worth as much as $60 billion, with Fox shareholders to receive one share of the portion of Fox that remains after the sale, along with shares of Disney stock. I don't care about all that stuff. But the big news for comic book fans, this would potentially allow Disney-owned Marvel Studios to regain control, or gain control in this case, of the full movie and television rights for the X-Men and Fantastic Four franchises. Now, Nick, it looks like after much consternation and much discussion, and of course the debate we had last week about this topic, that it's even closer to happening than it was a week ago. It's a sure thing at this point, right?
Seems like it. Just a matter of when, not if. And so
you mean
when, not if. Yes, good point. Solid point on your part. So yeah, we just have to kind of wait. And you know, the deal is just the first part of it. As we discussed last week, the next part is kind of figuring out what the landscape looks like. Do these side projects like Gambit and Deadpool and other things like that continue to move forward, or is everything folded into the MCU? And that's a story that probably won't be told, you know, for months to come. But I remain convinced that a good number of those reported 20 movies that the MCU has, at least in pre-development stages, have got to be for Fox properties. I think Kevin Feige knew, and I would be surprised if we don't see some official announcements of X-Men films in the MCU sooner rather than later. And by sooner, I mean within the next 6 months.
Yes, and one of those properties that is going to be particularly juicy for Marvel executives is going to be the X-Men, but in particular, the most popular X-Man, Wolverine. Hot off the heels of the success of the Logan film, which many would argue is the best of all the X-Men movies, Logan is now a free agent as a character and is about to be in the hands of Marvel again as a motion picture or television property. So naturally, this is something that has sparked the interest of people who have paid close attention to Hugh Jackman's comments over the years, because even around the time of the Wolverine, his last Wolverine movie before Logan, he was talking about the need to hang up the claws at some point and how the one thing that could get him to change his mind would be if he got to see Wolverine on screen with the Avengers. Well, suddenly, that option appears to be back on the board. So, naturally, people went, Collider, in fact, went straight to the horse to get the comments. They asked Hugh Jackman about this, and here is what he had to say. Quote, "It's interesting because for the whole 17 years, I don't know why I'm making him sound like John Lennon.
I was about to say, why is Hugh Jackman voice. John Lennon? Just read the damn thing, Greg.
"It's interesting because for the whole 17 years, I told Paul..." Anyway, yeah, for the whole 17 years, I kept thinking that would be so great. Like, I would love to see particularly Iron Man and the Hulk and Wolverine together. And every time I saw an Avengers movie, I could just see Wolverine in the middle of all of them, like punching them all in the head. But it was like, oh, well, that's just not going to happen. And it was interesting just when I first saw that headline. It was just the possibility of it, and who knows what's going to happen, obviously. I was like, hang on. But I think, unfortunately, the ship has sailed for me. But for someone else, I would like to see Wolverine in there. So, naturally, the headline out of this is that Hugh Jackman shuts the door on returning to the Wolverine role. However, I read that quote a little bit differently, Nick. I read it as, I think the word think yes. is very strong in there. And while I'm not saying it's going to happen, I'm not even sure it should happen, because I would love for it to happen, because I think Hugh Jackman is iconic and amazing and just as vital to his role as Downey and the rest of the cast are to their roles, but Logan was such a perfect ending for that character. However, I don't think that's completely shutting the door on the possibility, and I think if the right offer came along, the right amount of money, the right script, the right movie, the right director, I'm not ruling out the possibility of Hugh Jackman doing this if the offer were presented to him, and you damn right I would pay money to see it.
Well, let's be honest, you're going to pay money to see just about all the Marvel films at this point, so that's no
true.
That's no great compliment from you. But I agree. I don't think this is nearly as firm as some people are taking it as, and I, much like yourself, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I would actually put the odds of it happening at pretty low, but I think there's a tangible chance of it happening, at the very least, which is better than some would like for you to believe based on their clickbaity headlines.
Here's the question. Would you want to see it?
Yes. Yes.
As would I.
I mean, much is in the same light. If you remember a few years back, whenever the rumor was going around that Chris Nolan was going to direct Justice League and bring Christian Bale back as Batman, so many people asked the question, well, would you even want that to happen after Dark Knight Rises? And I said, yes, because I don't have to watch Dark Knight Rises and, you know, connect it to whatever would come after, you know, every time I watch it from then on. I can still... If Hugh Jackman comes back years from now, I will still be able to go and sit down and watch Logan, and it will be just as emotionally affecting and just as riveting as it was the first time. You know, the Star Wars prequels didn't hamper my ability to enjoy the original Star Wars trilogy, so you don't have to view every film as a, you know, you shouldn't let subsequent sequels affect your feelings on pre-existing films.
Right, particularly since this hypothetical movie would presumably take Wolverine from a different point in his life than what we see in Logan. So I would 100% love it. What's the next story on our list to get to, Nick?
Well, I suppose since we just talked about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we should move over to that corner over there of the L-shaped studios.
Oh, look at it right over there. It's all lonely. The loneliest corner in the L-shaped studio.
Yep. and it's the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
And in the DCEU corner, you and I are going to bitch and rant again because news came out this week as a result of Variety reporting that in the wake of Justice League's poor box office and critical reception, Jeff Johns, one of the co-heads of DC Films, is expected to remain as chief creative officer of DC Entertainment, though his role in the film wing will reportedly be lessened to something of a, quote, advisory capacity. In addition, John Berg, the other co-head of DC Films, is exiting the DC Films division and moving on to other production roles at Warner Brothers. So,
fuck it.
The John Berg of it all, I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I'm sure he brings a lot of knowledge and experience from a production standpoint, from the business side of the movie division. I get that. But if the report is true about Jeff Johns being moved into a, quote, advisory role when it comes to the films as opposed to a hands-on creative role, it's one of the stupidest and most short-sighted decisions they've made in the history of DC film, and that covers a lot of ground.
Absolutely. I mean, let me compose myself. This infuriated me when I read it, this report. We talk all the time about Warner Brothers being the most reactionary studio we've ever heard of in our lives, right?
Right.
But in this case, but this also reinstituted another thing that they're notorious for in our eyes, which is taking the wrong lessons from everything. That not only are they the most reactionary studio, they are the most misguided studio that I've ever encountered in terms of handling their comic book properties, because they are the most actionary and reactionary in that they will finally come up with a plan for something, commit to it, then hang on every single word of how people react to that one project to the degree that they will then change the course of their entire plan based on it. It's the age-old problem in public relations of overpromising, saying, this is what we're going to do, by God, and we're going to do it. And then you get cold feet because guess what? You didn't have a test project. You didn't have anything to go out there and test the waters with. So now you've told people you're going to have all these other things you're going to deliver. Then here's the thing. Once you do that, you have to deliver those things. What you can't do is then take your foot out of the water and say, nah, we're just kidding. We're going back to the drawing board, and do this repeatedly over the course of 10 years. So they've taken a guy in Jeff Johns and a guy in John Berg. They put them in charge of the studio, correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, after Batman versus Superman.
I think it was, either right before the movie came out or right after. It was one of the
other. I think it was right after when the critical reception was so bad for that movie, and they said, all right, we're going to bring these guys in. Suicide Squad was already in the can, okay? Wonder Woman was heavily into filming when Johns and Berg came on board in their power positions. So Justice League was being filmed literally right after Batman v Superman. They went straight to work on Justice League because the studio was that damn confident in Batman v Superman. If you recall, Nick, the standing ovations the studio executives were giving it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, when general audiences didn't share their passion for the film, they turned on the film and they turned on the project and everyone associated with it. And so they said, all right, people don't want this dark DC universe. We're going to bring in Jeff Johns and John Berg, and they're going to bring heart and hope back to the DC film universe. Here's the problem. They had almost no role in the initial creation of Justice League.
None.
Johns had an advisory capacity on Justice League, as he always does, but that was a Zack Snyder joint until they kicked him off and brought in Joss Whedon to finish the project. The oversight of Berg, I don't know. Maybe he had more oversight than I'm giving him credit for. Johns, in particular, will not be, his presence will really not be seen significantly until Aquaman.
Well, I mean, he also wrote the script for Wonder Woman, so I would argue that...
No, Alan Heinberg wrote that, didn't he?
I thought Jeff Johns co-wrote the script.
I don't know.
I'm fairly sure. Wasn't that the report that came out, was that Jeff Johns wrote the...
Johns is co-writing the sequel, I think, with Patty Jenkins, if I'm not mistaken. But possibly, I don't know. Let's find out. Luckily, there's this thing called the internet that I can pull up here and check out the writing credits for this film. Story by Zack Snyder, Alan Heinberg, and Jason Fuchs. Screenplay by Alan Heinberg. Let's see.
I just saw it.
Wonder Woman to you.
A story co-written by Heinberg, Snyder, Johns, and Fuchs. Fuchs, I don't know.
Whatever.
All right.
And Wonder Woman 2, he is co-writing with Patty Jenkins. So, you know, if anything, his influence was greater on Wonder Woman, which is the biggest success of the DCEU, than on any of the other movies. So Justice League is not a Jeff Johns joint. And that's why Jeff Johns was very quiet about Justice League on Twitter in the months leading into it. Johns has a heavy hand on Aquaman, a heavy hand on Wonder Woman 2, presumably other movies coming forward, or was going to have a heavy hand on those. And now you are punishing the wrong person for the failures of the movie studio. It's not Jeff Johns' fault that there are two different movies mashed together into one. It's not the movie studio's fault that Zack Snyder didn't get to make his film. It's not the movie studio's fault, or it's not Jeff Johns' fault that Joss Whedon didn't get to make his film. It's not Jeff Johns' fault that the CGI was atrocious. Like, that's what it's the same thing that happened with Green Lantern. The wrong people are taking the blame for this at the studio. And of course, it's everybody else's fault except the people up top that set the foundation, that set the standard for the studio. From Kevin Tsujihara on down, it's never their fault. It's everybody else's fault underneath them for what a disaster that studio has become. It pisses me off, Nick, because I wanted to see what Jeff Johns could bring to the movie universe, if he could bring that same level of wonder, pun intended, that he's brought to the comics at DC when he pretty much saved their asses and revitalized DC Comics in the 2000s. So... I'm really bummed out about this, Nick. At this point, if it weren't for me not wanting to lose him from the comic side, I would be completely on board with the people who are saying that Jeff Johns should leave DC and go work for Marvel now on their film side. Because, good Lord, man, it's just ridiculous.
It really is. Like, it's you know, and we knew this was a possibility that they were going to take the wrong lesson out of Justice League. And... you know, sacrifice Jeff Johns, and seemingly they've done that. Now, granted, he still technically maintains his role, but this whole advisory capacity thing really worries me, and it just lessens my faith that they're going to get this right. And it at this point, Greg, burn it down and start over. That's where I'm at. Burn it down and start over, because outside of Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman, they haven't given us a single thing that is on the level that we have come to expect from comic book films in the modern era. Like, I mean, start over from a conceptual standpoint, start over from a production standpoint, just start the whole thing over, because it is...
What would be wrong with instead of building around Batman or Superman, what would be wrong with building the entire film universe around Wonder Woman?
Nothing. Nothing. The only problem now would be that you've got this Wonder Woman who is narratively and you know, continually, if that's a word, tied to this version of the DC universe. That's the only concern there. And I think it's clear that this just ain't working, man. I think there's a certain image that could be used to describe DC film right now. It's often where a container of garbage or waste is set ablaze in some way.
Perhaps a... God, if only there was a term to describe it.
If only.
But one film franchise that's also a little bit in flux right now because of this Disney-Fox merger is the X-Men franchise. We don't know where it's going. We don't know what the status is going to be of some projects in the future. But what we do know is we're getting the X-Men Dark Phoenix movie in 2018. And it feels, until this week, Nick, like this movie's kind of flown under the radar a little bit. Or at least it feels that way to me. And we got an Entertainment Weekly cover this week with Dark Phoenix and some really interesting stuff on the inside. Well, one of the things that's become revealed in Entertainment Weekly by Michael Fassbender, no less, who plays Magneto, is that we are going to see the mutant island of Genosha in X-Men Dark Phoenix. Now, this has been confirmed by Simon Kinberg, the director and writer, as the mutant homeland. Magneto set this place for mutants that don't have a home to go to. They can seek refuge there. For people that are longtime X-Men fans, Genosha is well known. Things tend to not go well in Genosha, but it starts out as a good idea. Now, I do have some concerns about this, and they are as follows, Nick. I'm worried that Dark Phoenix its reach could be exceeding its grasp, or whatever the phrase is there, because we've often talked about sometimes comic book movies fail when they try to cram too many story points into one movie. And while I'm not saying that's going to necessarily happen here, after all, Michael Fassbender's been involved in the best parts of, you know, three of the last four X-Men movies, probably. So, but what's interesting is you're telling this outer space story, presumably about the Dark Phoenix, that you will, I would assume, involve, you know, going out, you know, meeting some of maybe not Starjammers, but maybe some of Elandra's people or whatever. And then you're also going to have Genosha, which I assume you'd have to explain and establish. That's not too much, but I'm worried that they could go down that path to try to cram too much in this. That being said, I am excited for it. I liked Apocalypse more than most people did, even though I acknowledge it wasn't a great movie. I enjoyed it more than most, and I'm looking forward to what they do in this film and how they render the Dark Phoenix character, and to see if it's better than when they did the Phoenix story back in X-Men The Last Stand.
Yeah, I think there are some concerning elements of this. I mean, now granted, I actually read a lot of the stuff that came out of this Entertainment Weekly deal, and apparently the method for introducing the Phoenix is that Jean overexerts herself attempting to block the Earth from some solar flares that come hurtling towards it. So they're not necessarily going to go all out cosmic with it, not with Lilandra and the Starjammers and all that stuff anyway, potentially. So maybe it won't be as jam-packed as you are fearing. And I certainly hope that it's not, because, you know, one of my issues with Justice League and other comic book films is when they try to pack too much story into one film. You know, I'm a fan of the decompressed storytelling, and I think after they got the first go-round at Phoenix so wrong in Last Stand, they really need to get this one right, because they won't get a third bite at the apple, I don't think.
Agreed completely. And it's not the only superhero film by any means in 2018. We're getting so many great, you know, high-profile movies, such as Avengers Infinity War, Black Panther, Aquaman. But another one that's flown under the radar is the Sony Pictures animated Miles Morales Spider-Man movie titled, I believe, Nick, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Is that correct?
I believe that is the case. I'm looking it up too. Yeah, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Well, they premiered the first trailer for that, and there are two aspects to it. Number one, I thought I was very underwhelmed. I didn't like the animation very much at all. I thought it looked really funky. But number two, it definitely looks like the target audience is going to be kids, as I suspected from the get-go.
Yeah, and that's fine. That's a smart move on their part for an animated film, especially one that's going to release around the holidays like this one is. On the topic of the animation, it was weird. Like, whenever they would show, like, shots of the city just sitting there, like, in still images, I thought it looked really cool. But whenever there was actual, like, motion thrown into it, I thought it looked really clunky. I think they were going for something of a cel-shaded type look to try and make it look like a comic book, but it kind of came off very poor in execution, I would say. That being said, I am a little concerned about the Spider-Verse element of everything. Now, granted, I understand why they're doing it, because it's kind of a marketing goldmine, because you can kind of introduce, you know, all these different Spider characters, you know, female Spider characters and minority Spider characters all at once and have, like, a massive marketing binge behind it. So it's a something of a smart move on Sony's part, I think. But, like you, I think we just have to realize that we are probably not going to be the target audience for this film. But I hope it does well, because, you know, I have a deep love for the character of Miles Morales.
Yeah, and I hope it does, too. I mean, it's aimed for kids, and one of the things that we have to stop doing as adults is judging kids' entertainment based on our adult standards. Because that's not ultimate, and you know this as a parent, that's not ultimately what kids are looking for, you know? They want simplistic. They want something they can understand and get behind. So maybe they'll pull that off, but certainly it doesn't appear like it's going to be my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. What is my cup of tea is actor Woody Harrelson. And Woody Harrelson is the latest big-name actor to sign on to Sony's Venom movie. With obviously, Tom Hardy is the A-list talent that is going to be playing the titular Eddie Brock Venom. But we've got Woody Harrelson signed on, and I don't think they've revealed his role yet, Nick. Is that correct?
I am not. Some are rumoring it's basically a bit like henchman-type role, but I don't know if that's been confirmed or not.
I don't even know what henchman Venom would fight, but I guess they could do Rhino.
Well, no, a henchman, not a supervillain, like a, you know, just a side character, you know, just a...
Oh, a side character, I got you. Well, you know, I always thought of, maybe it's because I grew up on the cartoon series, but I always thought of Rhino and Shocker as being henchman characters, though.
No, Rhino's a pretty major Spider-Man villain at various points.
Nevertheless, he was played by Paul Giamatti in the Amazing Spider-Man movie.
And Shocker was played by Bokeem Woodbine in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yes, that's true. One of those portrayals was better than the other, and I'll leave it to the audience to determine which I preferred.
You are an anti-Giamattiite.
Maybe I am, Nick. Maybe I am. Maybe I'll own that, unlike you owning your anti-archism.
Yeah, whatever. No, I don't think this is going to wind up being the case, but I think Woody Harrelson will be a hell of a carnage, a Cletus Cassidy, but I don't think that's in the cards.
I don't either. I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited about Woody Harrelson joining the movie. Like I said earlier, this is still a movie that I'm very skeptical about, but I'm tentatively engaged in what they're doing because of the cast that they are assembling.
And there is something cool about the idea of reteaming Woody Harrelson with his Zombieland director Ruben Fleischer.
True. I didn't think about that.
That would be a cool.
Oh my God. Do you think there's a chance Bill Murray could appear in this movie?
No, unfortunately, but he should.
Oh, God. He should appear in the movie as himself again. That would be amazing.
Bill Murray should play like a less yelly version of J. Jonah Jameson. Just a smarmy, like, sarcastic version of J. Jonah Jameson.
What do we have next for the folks?
Well, over on the television side from Marvel, we got news this week that we have a release date for the next Marvel-Netflix collaboration, as Jessica Jones Season 2 is going to premiere on March 8th, the entirety of the season. And alongside that, we got the first teaser trailer, about a minute of Jessica Jones Season 2 that we get to see, which is mostly just driven by her, you know, giving monologues and stuff and kind of a glimpse of what the season is going to be about, apparently explaining or exploring her origin, what happened to cause her to get these powers. And also, seemingly from the trailer and from stills we've seen, she is still being haunted by the memories of her encounters with the Purple Man, as seemingly David Tennant will reprise his role as Kilgrave, but only in hallucination form, which is a cool take, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Jessica Jones has been my favorite of the Marvel Netflix series, of the ones that I've watched. So I didn't need to watch a trailer. I'm all in on Season 2 of it. It's going to be awesome, I believe. And if it's anything like the first season, I'm not expecting it to be as good as the first season. But if it can be even close to the first season, it's probably going to take its seat right near the top of my pantheon.
And maybe one day you'll actually finish Luke Cage and Iron Fist and Defenders and Punisher so you can watch this.
And I really want to watch The Punisher, to be honest with you, Nick. That's the one I'm actually really excited about.
No, you're going to watch Iron Fist. Greg, you're going to watch the Iron Fist.
What if I don't want to watch the Iron Fist?
No, you're going to watch it.
What I will say is Jessica Jones, I don't know anything about her supporting cast. So I don't know who the villain's going to be, per se, of this season. But maybe it doesn't need a villain.
No, I mean, I don't know. I'm assuming that the character of, what's his name, Nuke, will be back at some point. I'm assuming that you'll have, you know, Trish and Trish's mom play a role. You know, I think they'll have enough antagonists without having to have anybody on the level of Kilgrave.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that piss us off, Nick, and a lot of things that make us happy. But one thing that does piss us off is occasionally the CW's bizarre scheduling. And the bizarre CW scheduling bug is about to strike again. Because when we come back from the mid-season break that we talked about earlier, Black Lightning has taken over Legends of Tomorrow's time slot after The Flash. When we return from the mid-season break, Supergirl will air brand new episodes starting January 15th through February 12th. Then, at that point, Supergirl will take a break.
A two-month break, right?
Say what?
A two-month break, right? Like nine weeks or some shit.
A two-month break while Legends of Tomorrow takes over her time slot for a nine-episode stint to finish out their season, presumably. I guess. I don't know. And then maybe goes back to their original airing. It's not really made clear.
Yeah, because, I mean, possibly Black Lightning might only be like a 13-episode this time. So they might just air those in 13 back-to-back-to-back, and then once that would line up perfectly, right? 4 and 9 would get you to 13, and then you could bounce Legends Tomorrow back over to its normal time slot, you know, for the end of the season.
Right. Well, this will put Supergirl running all the way into June. Yeah. June 18th would be the finale of Supergirl. This is just idiotic, in my opinion, Nick. I mean, of all the times that you have on that network, you couldn't have bumped another show. You can't. I haven't looked, but I can't imagine that Dynasty is doing ratings to justify not being bumped versus Supergirl or Legends of Tomorrow. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that, but I don't know. It just feels to me idiotic. I hate the way that they break up the momentum of shows at times. Now, they've been better about it in the last 2 years than they were prior with the notorious Arrow random breaks. But I don't know. I just don't think this is a good move.
No, I agree. It's a bad move completely. Breaks up continuity, you know, for those people who aren't DVR users. I mean, it's difficult for them to know when and where these shows are going to air. It's confusing for everybody, and it breaks up momentum from a storytelling standpoint, because now you got to remember what happened 2 months ago. I mean, it's going to be... We're not going to see the Legends again until February the 12th, so it'll have been over 2 months at that point. So absolutely ridiculous in my view, but, you know, what can you do at this point?
Yeah, it's one of those recurring issues, but one of those recurring good issues at the CW that we haven't actually seen in a while is the presence of Colton Haynes as Roy Harper on Arrow. But good news, everyone. Because Roy is making a dramatic return to Arrow. And Colton Haynes will be returning to the show to reprise his role as Arsenal, a.k.a. Roy Harper, for an arc in Season 6. He'll be coming back to Star City to help resolve an urgent matter with high stakes for the team. His short visit turns into something surprising when he reunites with Thea and sparks a change in both of their lives that will have long-lasting consequences. So, to me, Nick, that sounds like there's a chance they could be exploring the comic book concept of Roy and who is it, Cheshire, that have the ill-fated romance and that produces a child. Perhaps the same could happen with him and Thea.
Perhaps. I would think it's also possible that
you know, it could cause Thea to realize that they should be together, and she decides to leave with him and kind of remove her from the show, because I still don't understand why she wasn't killed off, because since returning from the coma, they've given her practically nothing to do. It seems like the writers are really at a loss for what to do with that character, and I think it'd make a lot of sense for her to kind of move off with Roy and possibly set both up for future appearances over on Titans once that launches.
That would be great. I would love to see that happen. I think Roy with Titan, if they could get him, would make all the sense in the world, or if not, then Thea, or both.
Right.
So that would be very cool. But always excited to see Roy back. It's been too long. I think he left at the end of season 3.
Yeah, and then he popped back up again for season 4, I believe, for like one episode or something. So,
hats off to Roy Harper. And hats off to Brian Michael Bendis, the legendary Marvel writer, had a near-lethal infection recently, a MRSA infection that left him unconscious and temporarily blind, and leading to a 4-day hospitalization. He's still not out of the woods yet. But it looks like he's mending at least and headed in the right direction. Nick, I know that Bendis is a writer that's very special to you, very important to you. And what were your thoughts hearing about this story?
Yeah, it was very, very scary. You know, he kind of kept it under wraps. Something he didn't really want a lot of people to know about, but, you know, MRSA is definitely nothing to play around with. And I could have swore that I just saw that he had been rehospitalized, but I don't know if that's the case or not.
I think so.
I think he had that the infection had recurred, but that it seemed like they had it under control. So he's going to have to, you know, it's one of those things that's going to have some long-term effects. And he said in a statement that both Marvel and DC have been very understanding about the entire situation and are letting him put his work on hold. So, which makes sense. You got to get your health right first before you can do anything else. So glad he's doing okay, but, was very concerned about him, you know, once I heard the news, but good to hear that he's going to pull through.
Definitely. Hoping he can recover and recover, quickly and 100% and get back to doing what he does best. Now, to close it out, Nick, I understand we have one more story on our rundown.
We do, and that, of course, is coming from the news from the world of Marvel Comics, where it seems as if Marvel is gearing up for another major event. That's right, after promising us no new events for 18 months, it looks like they're getting ready to build to a major Infinity-themed event, as they are releasing an issue titled Infinity Countdown Prime, to be written by Guardians of the Galaxy's Jerry Duggan and drawn by Original Sin's Mike Diodato Jr. And this is kind of telling the story of the Infinity Stones that have been newly reformed and scattered throughout the universe. And it seems like this is all, you know, building to some sort of massive Infinity event, probably to tie in with the release of one of the two upcoming Avengers movies, whether it be Avengers Infinity War in May of 2018 or the as-of-yet-untitled Avengers 4 in 2019. My prediction is that the event itself will not occur until 2019, thus enabling them to technically keep their 18-month promise, even if they break it in spirit, in my view, and that they will use a series of these Infinity Countdown-type issues to tell the story of the stones being hunted down before coming back together in the actual Infinity event itself.
Yeah, I could totally see that being the case, or I could see them just ignoring that 18-month thing and just going into another event. Maybe they could say that with an Axel Alonso idea, and he's out now, so whatever. But either way, I'm very evented out in comics right now, so I'm. But that being said, if you're going to do an event, it always piques my interest when you include the word Infinity.
Right.
So you know, that's cool. And I'm interested to see what they do with the stones. I know that was a big plot point of one of the recent stories a couple years ago, was destroying the Infinity Stones. So they're bringing them back, and let's see what they do with them and how they tell that story.
I did see that they're doing something a little bit different with them this time, and that one of the ones that's been discovered already, apparently Star-Lord discovered the Soul Stone, I believe, and it was massive, like the size of a moon at this point. So they're not going to be easily contained gems in all instances in this case.
And there's going to be a prose issue, which may be this, in fact, but there's going to be a prose aspect that will explain the history of the Infinity Stones, which will be cool for new readers. So,
oh wow, I didn't even know that. So yeah, I'm all on board with that.
With that being said, that wraps up the rundown. And Nick, what do we have for our loyal, wonderful, beautiful, fabulous listeners the next few weeks?
Well, as you alluded to, we are going to be trying to wrap up the month of December, just trying to get through the holidays. Very hectic time for everyone, including the old hard traveling fanboys. So we actually already got an episode in the can. Technically, it was the episode we had promised you for this week. We chose to hold it for the end of the month to get us through the Christmas holidays, as you're going to hear a roundtable discussion ranking our top five comic book movies of 2017. We'll be joined on that episode by Russell Sellers, Jennifer Smith, and Andrew Garner. Should be a very interesting episode featuring a somewhat unique major announcement at the end of the episode. So, yes, but that is slated for the last week of the month. But next week, as Greg alluded to earlier, we're going to have to coincide with the release of Star Wars: The Last Jedi. We are going to have a very special review of the first arc of Jason Aaron's Star Wars relaunch from a couple years ago. This will be Greg's first time reading it. You know, last year we did Kieran Gillen's Darth Vader, so this year we're doing Jason Aaron's Star Wars and kind of getting hyped up for the release of Star Wars. So looking forward to that. And against Greg's will, much as we did with Rogue One, I'll probably force you to listen to some Star Wars thoughts because I will have seen Last Jedi by that point. So interesting. Gonna be fun.
That's true. Better not have any spoilers, Nick. You spoil that movie for me,
I'm gonna spoil everything. I'm spoiling the entire thing.
You'll do that thing where you'll say, well, everybody kind of knew that going in, even though it's a blatant spoiler.
No, it's not.
You'll do that. I already know.
Well, you're going to be very surprised to learn that Carl is actually the Supreme Leader Snoke.
Oh, what would that? That would be, I would love it. I would absolutely love to see how Nick Duke would react to the one thing that he'll never bash, a Star Wars movie.
Now, that's not fair. Chandler, but that's one not Chandler, fair, Greg.
Chandler Riggs in a starring role.
I have bashed aspects of the prequels in the past. Do not.
Aspects. And that's only been over time. That's only been over the course of time as it's passed. But I want to know what you would do if a Star Wars movie had Chandler Riggs in a lead role.
Well, quite frankly, maybe we'll get to find out one day.
You never know. But, you know, before we get ready for next week, there's one last thing we need to do that we haven't done in a few weeks. Lightning round.
Oh, boy.
And right now, we're going to do a rank'em.
Okay.
We're going to do a rank'em of something that came up this past weekend at your illustrious birthday bash at the Duke Depot. We're going to rank the Family Feud hosts.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got this.
All right, we got...
Now you're going to have to tell me the names again.
We've got Richard Dawson.
Okay.
We've got Ray Combs.
Yes.
We've got Louis Anderson.
Yes.
We've got Richard Karn.
Right.
We've got... is that it? Steve Harvey? I feel like that might be the last one.
This is easy. This is easy. I'm ready.
Let me double check, Nick, and make sure that I'm not leaving anybody off. Family Feud hosts. John O'Hurley. I left him off. Who the hell is John O'Hurley?
John O'Hurley, if you Google him, if you see the image.
Oh, that guy.
Yes. I was about to say, okay, you'll know instantly who it is. It's just...
All right. You got yours? I want to hear it.
Oh, this is easy. Richard Dawson, number one. Landslide. Ray Combs, number two.
Okay.
Then it's going to be Richard Karn, number three.
Ooh!
I wasn't
expecting that.
Steve Harvey, number four.
Okay. Wow.
John O'Hurley, number five, and Louis Anderson, number six.
A controversially low ranking for Steve Harvey, in my opinion.
You just like to make fun of him. Like, you don't actually think he's good.
I like Steve Harvey. He's a good host.
Okay. Go ahead.
He's a good host. Okay. At number one, I'm going to go Ray Combs.
Oh,
grew up with him.
Wow.
At number two, I'm going to go Steve Harvey.
Oh, You are showing no respect to Richard Dawson.
Now listen, at number three, Richard Dawson.
No respect.
Richard Dawson, amazing in The Running Man, by the way. Richard Dawson, number three. Number four, I am going to go Richard Karn, Al from Home Improvement. At number five, I will go O'Hurley. And at number six, Louie Anderson.
There it is.
So with that being said, folks, let us know your thoughts on the Family Feud hosts. And also comic book stuff, but that doesn't matter. We want to know your Family Feud rankings. Let us know on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. You can email us, gregp at placetobenation.com, nickd at placetobenation.com. You can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just put in your little search bar, Place to Be Nation Comics and Facebook. And you will pull us up, join, have conversations about stuff. We have a lot of fiery conversations going on about a variety of things. Some things that I'm not even passionate enough to argue with about, but do anyway. So join the conversation. Let us know your thoughts on Coral and his fate. let us know your thoughts on Steve Harvey versus Richard Dawson.
I say you, he dead.
Let us know your thoughts on the brief Louie Anderson run as host of Family Feud.
It wasn't that brief. Apparently, it was like 4 years.
Oh, my God. Nevertheless, let us know your thoughts on this and many other things. And as always, we look forward to joining you next week.
Hard traveling fanboys.